My name is Dick Anderson. I'm an alcoholic.
Okay.
And I'm very, very grateful to be here tonight. This is, in a way, Barbara and I were talking, this kind of coming home for me, because as I get going here in a minute, you'll find out that I got, I was from Kentucky. Everybody in my family's from Kentucky, and I got sober in Louisville, Kentucky. My sponsor was a railroad man named Jack Sullivan, and I was here 4 years, but I've spent the last 26 years down in Georgia with my wife, Barbara, and strangely enough, even though I think I've been in spoken in Indiana about 30 times, this is the second or third time I've been back to Kentucky, and it always feels like coming home. And there's some people in this room that helped save my life, and so I'm very, very grateful for being here. This is the last time that I was here at Rough River. I was about a foot shorter and in a tent and at a Boy Scout jamboree. I was trying to think of the last time I'd been here, because I haven't been to this roundup, but I was a Boy Scout, and it was in the 50s. So, but I want to thank Juanita. Had asked us a couple times before. We weren't able to make it then, but I really appreciate it. And Dick and Marlene were part of this and helped us get connected here again. And I want to thank all of them for the opportunity. And I want to especially, I didn't realize exactly what this was until we walked in, and there's so much love and there's so much acceptance and so friendly. Some conferences you come into and everybody's kind of in their little groups, but here everybody comes up and gives you a big hug. And part of that, I believe, is because it's AA and Al-Anon. And I did not realize, because we AAs act differently when the Al-Anons are in the room. And I didn't realize until I got away from Louisville what a blessing I had, because of the meetings that I went to. Just about all of the meetings, there was an AA meeting on one side of the church and an Al-Anon meeting on the other side of the church. And afterwards, and most of them that I went to were speaker meetings. And afterwards, we would go to the Howard Johnsons, and that's where we'd sit and talk. And I found acceptance. I listened to Al-Anon speak, and I accepted responsibility for the damage that I had done. But at the same time, I was accepted and loved, and I became a human being again. Thanks in a great deal to the Al-Anons and their help and their love and support. So I'm especially looking forward to visiting with a lot of you this weekend. I am looking forward to hear the two speakers from Montana, but I'm sorry that my good friend Keith and Julia are not here. Keith is my best friend and has been for some time, and he's had some illness and some struggles in the last year or so, and they weren't able to come, and he's one of the finest men I know. I did not come from a family where alcoholism was part of the discussion. My dad was a P-51 pilot at Bowman Field just back from World War II, and he met my mom, who was a stewardess for American Airlines, and the two of them got married, and there's a picture from the Courier Journal that we had cut out of the two of them. It says, "Honeymoon in the sky," because American Airlines sent them off to Acapulco, and 9 months later, I was the gift that had arrived. My mom's father was a coal miner in Harlan County, Kentucky. She's from a place called Lynch. My dad came off a farm in Hopkinsville, but he came from a military family. My name is Dick Anderson. My great-great-great-grandfather was General Dick Anderson, who was a 3-star general under Robert E. Lee. His great-grandfather was Richard Clo Anderson, who's buried up in Louisville Cave Hill, who was a general under George Washington. My little sister is a retired bird colonel. My dad's a retired bird colonel, wearing the Army Cross. It's a couple silver stars, 3 distinguished flying crosses. Well, I've got a nephew that's a West Point grad. We've had, I think, 10 or 11 West Point grads in the family. And it goes on and on and on. Even on the grand generation down from me, we've got 3 Green Beret Special Ops running around in the Middle East someplace right now. So I was born into this family where at family reunion we had a lemonade and iced tea and that so forth. Nobody told war stories. I was, as far as I know, the first one hanging out at the VFW. I came back from Vietnam and I joined the VFW so I could drink in a dry county. And but my family wasn't like that. I didn't even know all the heroic stories about my dad. This was a humble family who just served. And from the very beginning, if you know anything about me, I didn't fit into a family of humble, heroic people. And I knew that I didn't fit in. And from the very beginning, I felt like I was at odds. And if you're new, there's something great about Alcoholics Anonymous that I did not have before I got here, and that's called a sponsor. That's somebody who knows everything there is to know about me, and I can tell them good and bad, and they accept me, and they'll also help me correct some of the parts of my life that aren't so good. But I didn't have that growing up. Everything about my beginning when I was growing up gave me the tools to live a good life. I was a member of YMCA, 4-H, church, Boy Scouts I already talked about. But even there was a certain expectation, just like the rest of my family. If you were a Boy Scout, remember what we were supposed to be. We were supposed to be trustworthy, loyal, helpful, friendly, courteous, kind, obedient, cheerful, brave, clean, and reverent. What an order. I couldn't even begin to go through with that. So from the very beginning, I did not fit into this family, and I didn't know how to get along with them, I could not even express myself. And I was afraid that if I told them that I was this kid that was stealing a nickel off my mom's dresser so I could go get a candy bar, that I would get kicked out of this family. And so I didn't know what to do. And I found something. I grew up, I'm 57 years old, and I've coming this June the 8th, I'll be sober 30 years. So I got sober when I was 27. So I've been sober a lot longer than I drank, so things are clearer now. But when I first came in here, I would have told you that my drinking problem started when I had my last two or three years, because I was wallowing around on the floor of a basement apartment and bleeding from my stomach and had lost the ability to control my kidneys and bowels. I had no sense of anything. I was disengaged from my family, and I had lost any sense of self-esteem. I had lost any sense of purpose, and I really didn't belong to that family at all. I had terminal cancer a year and a half ago, and that's part of what I saw on the letterhead here that it says a gathering of miracles, and I was supposed to be dead about a year ago. But part of what I do have to do is drink a little juice, because I need to keep some sugar going. So here I was, and as a kid, I could not relate to anybody. I couldn't tell anybody what was going on with me. But something happened in the 50s, and it was an invention called the television, and it was black and white. And I somehow could relate to what was going on television when I couldn't relate to what was going on in real life. I couldn't tell my scout leader or my Boy Scout leader, the Little League coach, or especially the colonel or anybody else in the family what was going on, but I could relate. And even the shows that I watched at this point had a really good moral message. They were Ozzie and Harriet and Father Knows Best, Leave It to Beaver, and the Andy Griffith Show. And somehow, if Opie or Wally got off the beam, by the end of the show, gently, without any real judgment, and I was grew up as a Baptist, so I was afraid of judgment, Dad would take his pipe and push it to one side, and Opie or Wally would kind of learn their lesson and get back on the beam. And this became my moral compass. I watched television, and somehow I could feel connected, and I could feel right. And if I had a problem, I took it to the TV, and I watched what Opie or Wally did. And whatever they did was what I did. And in the meantime, I tried to behave and tried to do all the things I was supposed to in real life, but I was doing it because I had no way to relate to anybody else. So, and my first spiritual experience, when I went to the East Drive-In in Louisville, Kentucky in 1956, and I saw my first color movie. It was not only color, it was Technicolor. It was 120 feet wide up there on the screen. It was the Ten Commandments. And I had never seen anything like this. The big book says that lack of power is our dilemma. And that was exactly how I felt. I'm born into this family of heroes. They're all, and I would watch as my dad would go off in his flight suit, and it was like Steve Canyon going off, or Jimmy Stewart. My mom was June Allison, and I just didn't fit in. And now, up on this, I mean, I'll figure this out. I'm going to just sit right there. Now, up on this big screen, I see more power than I've ever seen in my whole entire life. because what I'm watching is Moses with this staff, and all he does is move it to one side, and the Red Sea parts. And I had never seen that kind of power. And I'd heard about it, but I'd never seen that kind of power. And I made a decision that night because that was the kind of power I wanted. So I made a decision, two decisions that night. One, I wanted to be around that business, whatever that business was. And God was listening because for the last 35 years, I've made a living writing and producing and doing TV and film. But the second decision that I made was that I absolutely knew that I wanted to be on God's side, because I saw what Charlton Heston had done to Yul Brynner. And so I went down the next day at Linden Baptist Church, got dipped and dunked, much to the surprise of my parents, who didn't know that I was so religious. But I went down there, and I was emotionally, absolutely, I really believe that I took a sincere third step. I absolutely wanted to turn everything I had. And I remember the hymn that was playing, We Gave Our All, and I come down, and I gave everything I had. But I did what some people do in Alcoholics Anonymous. We come in and we make a decision and we don't work a fourth, fifth, sixth, seventh, eighth, ninth step, but I didn't have a sponsor, nobody to tell me how it worked. I didn't change, I didn't do anything to change, and nothing about me changed, so my life didn't change. I had turned my life over to God, and for some reason or another, I thought he just didn't want me. And I felt alone and more afraid than I had before I made that decision. So my second spiritual experience was when I was 14 years old. My buddy Dave got his older brother to give us a six-pack of Ertl's 92, beer they don't make anymore, and a half pint of gin. And I drank the Ertl's, and he drank the gin. And from the very beginning, I was not a stay-at-home drunk. I was a go-to-town drunk. And going to town in St. Matthews, where we were camped out, meant hitchhiking to the White Castle. And if most of you are around here, you know what a White Castle is. And I have to explain that in some parts of the country. And so... We hitchhiked up to the White Castle, and I was feeling absolutely no fear. The kids wear these T-shirts that say no fear, and that's the way I was feeling at that point. And I was tall and proud and felt no fear at all. My buddy Dave wasn't having the same spiritual experience that I was having, and he was starting to feel a little woozy on the gin. So we get to the White Castle, and I had seen in... And he's starting to feel a little bit more woozy. And I had seen in Perry Mason, when you have too much to drink, if you have a cup of coffee, it'll sober you up so you can talk to the police. So I'd never had a cup of coffee, and neither my buddy Dave. But I ordered Dave a cup of coffee, and it didn't have the desired effect. Dave threw up down the stainless steel counter at the St. Matthews White Castle. And it turns out if you're looking for a Louisville City policeman at midnight, the best place to find him is at the White Castle. So two of them came down and asked me what was wrong with my friend, and I said, well, nothing. He's just had a little bit too much to drink. Well, how old is he? 14. How old are you? 14. So I was in Louisville City jail 4 hours after I took my first drink. And that was pretty much the end of my social drinking. I drank as much as I could, whenever I could, and I told you before that when I got to this program, when I first came in, I would tell you that my drinking problem started that last 2 or 3 years when I was coming to, passing out on the floor of that basement apartment. But here's what I did the first 3 times I drank. The first time I drank, I end up in jail 4 hours later in a family that doesn't go to jail, and the colonel wasn't too happy. Nobody was too happy. And the second time I drank something called cherry vodka. If you're new, if you're thinking of having a slip, I can think of a lot better things to have one with. But it got me there quicker. And the third time I drank Kentucky Straight Bourbon Whiskey, which was my drink until I got to Alcoholics Anonymous. I didn't care about the taste of any of the three of these. What I cared was they gave me that feeling, they gave me that feeling that it took all the fear out, and it got me there much quicker, and I felt tall and strong and without fear, quicker, faster, and deeper. And that's the way I drank from the very beginning. Here's the other thing that happened during that first 2 month period of time. Before I started drinking, I was an all-American kid. I may not have been felt like much on the inside, but I was in the advanced program at Wagner High School. I was starting quarterback on the JV football team. I had all kinds of honors. I did all the things I was supposed to do. Had 1480s on the SATs, which could have got me into Harvard or Brown or Yale or any other place. But then I start drinking. I was dating the girl who was the captain of the JV cheerleaders. And we were talking to each other on the phone every night for about an hour or so, and I absolutely was in love with her. I cared more about her than I did about anybody, about my school, about my family, about church, about anything that I was involved in. That girl was the most important thing in my life. And when she found out that I had been locked up for drinking that first night, she called me up and said, "We need to have a talk. My dad has a drinking problem, and you don't know about it, and it's not pretty when he drinks. And I don't want to be around that, and so I'm going to have to ask you not to drink when we get together." And so I broke up with her. The most important person in my life I broke up with just because she didn't, and I'd only had something to drink a couple of times. That's how much power alcohol had over my life from the very beginning. So I took off and I drank, and that's all I did. I was drinking around the clock. I was a daily drinker when I was in high school. I was drinking country club malt liquor before I went to homeroom. I got locked up 22 times before I got to Alcoholics Anonymous. I got locked up 6 times my senior prom and my senior year in high school. I got locked up at my senior prom for a felony. Prior to this, it had been all drunk in a public place or underage drinking or whatever it was. But now, and some of you may remember this, I had my first real adventure because we made national news. I was locked up. When we have proms in Louisville, we also have something else about that time called the Kentucky Derby, and I got locked up and put in the felon tank, and there were 8 of us in the felon tank, and it was me and 7 Black Panthers that had been locked up in the West End of Louisville for carrying a bunch of explosives in to disrupt the Kentucky Derby back in the 60s, and some of you will remember that, made national news. And so the next morning, like Forrest Gump, like this character out of a movie, here come those 7 Black Panthers and me in my little powder blue tuxedo jacket. And none of the other kids that went to Wagner got to get into stuff like this. It was an adventure. And that's the way I thought about it. I'd already developed some skills as a writer, so, you know, I read about Hemingway and Fitzgerald and all these writers, and they drank. They were two-fisted drinkers. They went out, and I wasn't reading about the fact that Hemingway shot his head off with a shotgun, but, you know, that was a detail I left out. But I was in the middle of this. I was still paying a lot of attention to film. I went to see The Graduate, came out when I left and went to, I was going to go to Brown or Harvard, but I ended up going to the University of Kentucky. I had a little trouble almost getting out of high school. And a film came out then called The Graduate, and I saw it 10 times. And again, these things had an extraordinary real life I couldn't deal with, but film helped me. I felt like I fit in. So I saw The Graduate 10 times, and I had made it all the way through school without smoking. I started smoking and had an affair with an older woman. She'd be about 86 now. But that's the way I lived. And I was down at school. Now, I knew something after I started drinking. Anything I started, I was going to fail at. Anything I started, I was going to quit. And so that's exactly how I conducted my life. I had another girlfriend lined up over here when that one was through, because I knew I was going to be out of one and into another. Now, I was in ROTC at UK. I didn't go to West Point or anything else, but I was in ROTC, and my family assumed that I would go in just like the rest of them and be a military officer. And one night we were drinking a little bit, and for some reason I thought that I was going to miss out on Vietnam. So I decided that I was reading a lot of Hemingway. We sat, we drank, we enlisted. And so I joined up, and I didn't want to miss out on it. And I had 2 tours in Vietnam. Now, I had never seen any drugs in high school. I had never seen any drugs. I mean, the only thing we had was, you know, was bourbon and beer and whatever they were drinking. So I'd never seen any drugs. But I'll go to Vietnam, and now I found a group of people that I could look down on, because over there were a lot of people that were doing drugs. And I always, in place of some of my ammunition, I always carried an extra bottle, just in case I was caught behind enemy lines. But I always had an extra bottle stashed somewhere on me. But I looked at these people that were doing drugs, and I looked down on them because I felt like if you were doing drugs, you lacked self-discipline. And this is the way I lived. But I did manage to make it through both. You know, I'd had enough military upbringing. I got through and in and out of there without getting, I got a good discharge when I came back out. And but I knew that something was going to happen. I knew I wasn't going to be able to make a career out of it there. And something was starting to change in me, and I knew I needed something to kind of anchor myself and settle down. And I had been engaged, I guess by this time, a lot of people come in the program, they've been married lots of times. My relationships never went that far, but I was engaged six times. And but I had fallen in love with this girl, and she was there in Louisville, and I decided to get out of the service and move back here, and we were going to get married, and we absolutely loved each other. We were talking about when we were going to set the wedding date. We just needed to figure out what to do with her husband, and he was an attorney for the Nixon administration, an advanced man, so he was traveling a lot, which was convenient. But now I was an expert marksman when I was in service, so now I'm trained in firearms and bourbon, and we had a few run-ins, and I went after him a couple times with a shotgun, and he had trained with different weapons. He came after me a couple times with a warrant, but you know how we are. If nothing else, we are absolutely persistent, and I would not give up until I had gotten her this marriage broken apart, and we really were getting married. And I came back, and I actually got a really good job at an ad agency. I'm writing, producing commercials, and I'm doing what I want to do. And this is going to lead me to making these big feature films. But I'm making pretty decent money, and I've got a nice apartment, and I'm living over off of Newburgh Road. And we decide that we will get married, and we've got the wedding date set. But I was a daily drinker in high school, and by now I'm a daily drinker who goes on binges on top of the daily drinking. The daily drinking kept me going around the clock, but now and then I go on binges, and I could not control when I was going to go to sleep. So there were a couple times I didn't come home, and I wasn't messing around that I know of, but I just didn't come home, and she felt ill at ease about that apparently, and decided that we should kind of postpone the wedding. And so when anything like that happened, this is how I lived from the time that I thought God turned his back on me. When something didn't work out right, I needed to have something to make me feel okay. And after a while, I was drinking all the time, so it had to be something else. So we split up, and I go looking for something else. Now, I'd been in Vietnam, and they had a lot of things over there I hadn't seen here. And one of them was I'd seen Playboy magazine here, but I'd never seen Penthouse. And Penthouse was, I guess, a more advanced version of the Playboy thing. And in it, they had this section called Letters, or the Forum. And in there were a lot of concepts. And we would talk about these concepts when we were over there in Vietnam. And one of these concepts was a concept called Ménage à Trois. And we talked about that a great deal. We thought that, and obviously I didn't know French at the time, which was strange because I was also in French Indochina, but I didn't know that either. There, as it turns out, there was a great deal I didn't know. But while we're drinking, we figure out that I would like to have one of these menage. And just something clicked, something I remembered, you know, how you keep something stored up here. So I came back. I had actually discussed this several times with my fiance, but her having formerly been married to a Nixon aide, she was a little conservative, so she wasn't going for that. And so... she kicks me out of this relationship. I'm hurt. I'm crushed. And I think, well, you know, now is the time to find this menage. Now, this is in Louisville, Kentucky, pretty conservative place, especially back in the 60s. I live on this apartment building where there are 11 of us. We all know each other in this apartment building. Most of us, we're all veterans, real conservative group. And on the weekends, whoever got up first on Sunday morning would pop the keg, and we'd play volleyball out in the pool. And so this was so none of those guys were going to tell me. But I really bring this up because this is the kind of trouble you can get into if you don't have a sponsor. I now go to another. If I'm going to have this menage, I'd like for the two girls to like each other. And so there was another concept in there apparently I didn't understand called lesbian. And so if you're new, see me after. But they're not waiting for us. So now I'm trying to find this lesbian place to go to, and I don't even know who to ask, but you know how we are. And I persisted, and I managed to find this place, and it was someplace downtown Louisville. And I go down there, and I'm having a good time, and I'm smoking my cigarettes and drinking my whiskey, and it's me and this one woman sitting there, and they had a piano bar, I remember, and we're sitting and singing, and I'm getting along fine with the woman over here, but I know she's a big woman, she's a veteran, but I know there's not going to be any menaging, and so. Uh, and, and but you know how it is, and I'm smoking my cigarettes, and I've got that whiskey thing going, and you know how you just get to a certain point of the evening where you've got that kind of raspy come hither voice, and you're not going to get any sexier. And so this is something's going to happen soon, or it's not going to happen at all. And about that time, at the end of the room, these doors opened up, and it was like this beautiful, flowing, there was some kind of activity going on up there, and there was another TV show called The Loretta Young Show, where this strikingly beautiful woman comes just flowing down the staircase in this long gown. Well, that was in black and white on TV, so I don't know what color Loretta Young's hair was, but this, in this case, this was this absolutely striking, beautiful redhead who had this beautiful gown and these blue eyes and just came flowing down the steps, and all of a sudden we're moving towards the middle of the dance floor, and we're holding on to each other, and we're kissing, and we're in love, and you know how when you're in love, you take three steps over here and you can't get enough of each other, and you start kissing some more, and then you move over here and take another three steps, and we just could not get enough of each other. And then I remembered what I was there for, and I said, by the way, do you have a girlfriend who might want to join us tonight? Her name was Erica. She said, well, why don't we get to know each other tonight, and maybe tomorrow we'll add somebody. And so I thought, I am so glad I did not marry that other woman. And so Erica and I are headed back to my place, and it's Saturday night, and this is one good-looking redhead, and the next morning I'm going to take her. You know, if you had a stayover on Saturday night when they popped the keg to play volleyball, the next morning you went out and took your stayover to introduce them to all your alcoholic friends to see if they fit in. It was a great life. And so I'm looking forward to this. And again, drugs rears its ugly head. Because Erica pulls out a pill that was big enough to choke a horse. It was called a Quaalude, which actually was a horse tranquilizer, and said, would you care for one? And I said, no thanks, I don't do drugs. So I drank a little bit, another shot of Wild Turkey, and shortly thereafter, two things happened. Erica passed out, and I found some equipment I definitely wasn't looking for. And after three or four days, I said, this is not right. This is the point at which my moral compass stopped working, because I had never seen Opie or Wally ever deal with this in any episode. And it really was kind of downhill from there. I moved out, and you know how we are. I mean, I got fired from that job with that agency, a fine agency. But I'd already gotten another job with the biggest agency in the world. And I was up in New York, and I was flying around on Learjets and staying at the Beverly Hills Hotel, and I was doing Coca-Cola commercials, and I won a couple of Clios, and I did one of those commercials that you see every year that they tried out at Super Bowl time. And so I was actually getting paid more money than I could spend. But my body was starting to break down, and I couldn't even depend upon myself to get through a recording session. And I remember being in a studio at about 10 o'clock in the morning in New York, and I was recording some music for Coca-Cola, and I couldn't talk. I couldn't talk. I was just shaken, and I just left them in that studio and walked around the corner to this kind of dingy hole-in-the-wall bar, and I hadn't been there before, and I walked in, and the bartender, it was 10 o'clock in the morning, and he poured me a triple. And I remember thinking, I wonder how he knows I'm a big drinker. Because that was what I thought I was. I thought I was a big drinker, and I took that and I shook it all over the bar. And I had seen another movie called Lost Weekend with Ray Milland, where he puts a towel around his neck and around his arm, and he brings that drink up to his mouth. And that's what I did. And I got it up, and I got that triple down. And then he poured me another triple, and I got that down. And the shaking stopped, and I was able to go back to that studio. But before I did, I was looking in there. It's one of the little bars that has the mirror up there, and I was looking in the bottom of that glass and looking up at the mirror, and I didn't even recognize the person I had become. And I was 25 years old, and I couldn't understand what had happened to that kid whose parents had loved him so much and had wanted everything for him. And I left there, and it was shortly I got fired from that job. Well, they moved me to Atlanta, and where the Coca-Cola headquarters is, and tried to get me some job. And, you know, how we used to do is, you know, if you had somebody who had a drinking problem, you used to move them around and try to take care of them. And they tried to do that with me, and I couldn't even accept that. And I ended up taking my severance pay because they fired me, and I was out asleep at that basement apartment, and I was passed out, coming to, and passed out, coming to. And that's all I did. I had not paid my rent in some time, and the only thing I did was, and I was bleeding from the stomach, and I was hallucinating, and I was hearing things coming out of the heating ducts, and all, my only job was to now and then get up to the liquor store and get a bottle and come back. And I got evicted from that apartment, and when they give you an eviction notice, they don't give you 2 days. They give you 6 weeks or 2 months, but that's never enough time for an alcoholic. And so it snuck up on me, and they were going to evict me. And the night before they were evicting me, I went up to that liquor store that was close by, and I hadn't been driving for some time. And I was estranged from my family. I hadn't seen them in some time. Hadn't seen anybody. Even the people that I used to drink with didn't come around anymore. And I went up to that liquor store, and the guy said, just a minute, he brought out the owner, and he said, we know this check is no good, and we know the last so many checks you've written are no good, and we want to ask you not to come into this liquor store anymore. And as humiliating and degrading as that was, the only thought I had was, oh, God, I hope he gives me that whiskey. And that was my answer to everything. As long as I had the whiskey, it didn't matter that I was going to be living on the street. It didn't matter that I would have to find someplace else to hustle the whiskey. I just needed the whiskey. And he did give me that bottle of whiskey, and I walked back around the corner to that place where I lived, and as I was coming around the corner, I slipped on something, and the bottle left my hand and hit the concrete and broke and poured all over the concrete, and there was no place to go. And I was more afraid at that point than I ever was in a firefight in Vietnam, because I had nothing to fight it with, and I had no place to go. And I got angry, and I had been angry at God for a long time. I thought most of what was happening to me was because God had turned his back on me when I was a kid. And all I had as furniture was a plastic bar with two stools, a mattress that was soaked because the floor was, I hadn't paid the rent in a long time, and was, but I had a weapon. And I put a bullet in the chamber, and I got ready to pull the trigger, and I started screaming at God because I was so angry that I was getting ready to leave. And I was 27 years old. And I just started at the top of my lungs yelling, God blanket, God blanket, God blanket. And something broke, and I started saying, God help me, God help me, God help me. And a moment of silence kind of spread over me, and that scene from another film I'd seen 50 times drunk, Days of Wine and Roses, came to my mind, where I saw Jack Klugman walk up to Jack Lemmon and say, I understand you need help. I'm from Alcoholics Anonymous. So I put the gun down, and I walked up to a phone booth on a street corner in Atlanta and called the operator, and I didn't even have a dime. I had one outfit of clothes. It was a pair of yellow brownish pants, which were kind of practical at the time, a blue shirt, and some loafers that were worn out on the bottom. And I called the operator, and I remember started crying. I said, I think I'm an alcoholic. I need help. And this woman had heard of Alcoholics Anonymous, and she connected me with a woman named Helen, who had just started working at the central office in Atlanta. And Helen is still working at the central office in Atlanta. And she sent out a man, and I would not be here if Helen hadn't answered the phone. And she sent out a man who was a member of Alcoholics Anonymous, and I would not be here if he had not come out to talk to me and do an actual wet 12-step call. And his name was Ed, and he was a railroad man. And I hadn't had much to do with railroad men before I got to Alcoholics Anonymous. They're all over the place after I got here. And he came out, and he was a year and a half sober. He lived in a little place like a one-room apartment with a hot plate, but he had a brand-new car. You know how we are. And it was a Pinto. It wasn't much of a car, but it still had the sticker on the side of it. And he came, and if he had said anything to me about a lecture or anything else, I wouldn't be here. But he did as the big book tells us, he relived the horrors of his past. And I trusted him, and I most completely took a third step with him, and I gave him everything I had, which was me and that worn-out pants and shirt and those worn-out shoes. And he took me, and he took me to a place to help me dry out. And they helped me dry out, and I didn't have any money, and they still let me stay there and dry out. And I had been drinking enough without eating for several years that I had a little bit of wet brain. And so it took me sometimes several months, almost like a year and a half, before I could actually read. And I had no place to live. So the big book says when we take that third step, that God provides whatever we need, as long as we're trying to stay sober and trying to build some kind of life. And I was clueless, but somehow somebody gave me a car that I could drive up to Louisville, and I got up here, and for the first few months especially, I mean, I always had a place to stay. And at that time, there were a lot of wet 12-step calls, and I would stay up at night with the drunks, and that was one way I could do it. And I poured coffee over at the Token Club, and from the very beginning, I got a job. And if you're new, especially, I don't know if anybody in here is new, but if you're new, the best way to make sure that you stay in Alcoholics Anonymous is to get a job in AA. And I couldn't be the secretary or the treasurer or do the, they wouldn't trust me with the coffee or even the chairs. But at that time, if you came into Alcoholics Anonymous in Louisville, Kentucky, if you didn't smoke, it was mandatory that you learned how to smoke. So I was the ashtray guy for my home group at the Token Club. And they had those little round ashtrays, which were gold and blue and red. They were Christmas colors. And they were designed by an engineer so that the cigarette ashes would chemically fuse with the metal itself. And you had to scrub them out with some SOS pads. And I was a good ashtray guy. And I belonged. It gave me something that I could do. Because at that point, because of the way my brain was working, I would cry at the wrong places and laugh at the wrong places and ask you the same question 10 times. And nobody ever called me stupid. Nobody ever turned me away. Everybody just said, you know, it'll be okay. It's going to get better. And they did. And they kept me coming. And I had been assigned a sponsor, and it was that railroad man named Jack Sullivan. And I show up, and I'd written. Yeah, I'm doing better. I'd written on the back of my hand his name and his number, and I was told to call him when I got to the city limits. And I called him, and he said, "You're going to meet a guy named Harry H., and he's over at the Tuesday night group." And I said, "Well, how will I know him?" He said, "Well, he'll be the biggest guy in the room." And he was, and I went in there, and Harry met me, and he introduced me to Mike E., who's been gone now for a little while, who introduced me to Sonny, who introduced me to, and all of these people were in there. And every one of those people that I got sober with, every one of those men, either died sober or is still sober. None of them had a slip. So I have to believe that what they gave to me was the right way, for me anyway, to stay sober, because I haven't had a desire for a drink since then. And these men literally saved my life, and there were a lot of them. There are too many to thank, but it's like coming home. One of the people that was instrumental in this, and I'll tell the story in a minute, was Bill H., who's sitting on the third row back there. But there was something that took place at a luncheon at the Galt House. But anyway, they got me in, and they also told me, they didn't tell me that if I'd go to 90 meetings in 90 days, I'd be okay. I never heard that, actually. What I heard was that don't drink, read the big book. Also, what I was hearing was that I would have to change, and the way I would change is by working through the steps, by doing house cleaning, and I would need to trust God, and I had a lot of trouble with God. So they said, "Well, try working through the house cleaning and just trust us," and that's what I did, and I kept going at it. And because of the brain problems that I had, it took me some time before I really got to a real fourth step. The first three or four that I only had one resentment on, which I don't even remember what that was, but obviously they weren't any deep root cause inventories. But I kept hanging with these guys, and I started to feel better, and I started to look a little bit better, and I started to be able to, and about a year and a half in, you know, I was at the point where I was starting to remember things, and I got everything down on that house cleaning. And when I did that house cleaning, I had a chip on my shoulder about everybody. I mean, I hated everybody. I hated God, I hated Jesus, I hated the people at that church, I hated anybody who had money, I hated people who, all the women that I'd been chasing after all my life, I hated all the guys that were better looking that got all the women I'd been chasing after. I mean, there was nobody. I was resentful of my dad because he was, it didn't make any difference. I've been walking around all my life with a chip on my shoulder about everything, and that's no way to live, sober or drunk. And so I had to get rid of that, and I started getting rid of it, especially the things started happening when I was halfway through the ninth step, like it says. And I got through that house cleaning, and the guys that I ran with went down and did an annual house cleaning. They believed in doing an annual house cleaning, and we did it at Gethsemane, which is a Trappist monastery near Bardstown. And I went with them, and there were some old-timers, and it helped me. And I start my life just started changing a little bit at a time, and my brain started getting a little bit better at a time. And I went to make amends, and that's when the miraculous things started taking place. And I made amends to that Linden Baptist Church because I called them hypocrites for a long time, and because God had turned his back on me, I knew that this place was full of hypocrites. And I got up on a Sunday night, and I was told that amends meant making amends, not apologizing. And I did apologize, but I said I would like to make amends by being part of your church and by making a contribution for a couple of years. And two things happened, several things happened, but two wonderful things happened as a result of that. First, I found unconditional love. And my life started to open up, so I realized that I'm a child of God and that I fit in not just in AA, but every place, that I belong here. And I had never felt like I belonged any place, my family, any place else. The second thing that happened was I was at the point where I was allowed to date. I was a couple of years sober, and so I was allowed to go out if I could find somebody to go out with me, and it wasn't going all that well, and I'm convinced that if I had kept doing it my way, it wouldn't have gone all that well, because I think what I was kind of looking for was a go-go dancer who needed some spiritual guidance, and so that night when I got up and apologized to that Baptist church, there was this beautiful blonde seminary student. She was a seminary student and a virgin, and I wasn't looking for either one of those. She happens to be my wife, and you'll hear her speak tomorrow morning. And I met my wife making a ninth step, not a 13th step. And we've been married and deeply love each other and have a good marriage and far better than anything I could have worked up. So God connected me with my soulmate because I was just making an amends. What if I hadn't made that amends? And I went and I made amends to this agency that I'd stolen from, and I was told if you pad your expense account and don't pay your bills, that's called stealing, which was a different perspective for me. And so and I went back, and the controller was named Heartless, and we called her Heartless because she was so tough. And I went and I said, I don't know how much money I stole, but I think it was about $30,000 that I padded on my expense account, and I don't know how I'm going to pay that money back. And I was expecting fully to go to jail because I was told I should accept responsibility for what I'd done. I could be forgiven, but I was still going to have to make amends. And she started crying. And she said, did you know that there were a group of us who knew that you were in trouble? And we had been praying for you. And suddenly we realized that God does for us what we cannot do for ourselves. And the miracles were starting to take place. And one of my final amends was made at another church, a church I had really, I mean, even done physical damage to. I was angry at God, so I thought I'd attack his churches for a while. And I went back to that, and I couldn't find anybody. And I walked in there, and I couldn't find anybody in that church. And I went into the chapel, and I realized who I was there to forgive. And I got down on my knees and started to forgive God. And we say it at the end of a lot of meetings when we say the Lord's Prayer, forgive us our trespasses as we forgive those who trespass against us. And what I was doing was still asking him to forgive me and not forgiving him. And I had been angry at God for a long time. And I started forgiving God, and I had one of the most profound experiences I've ever had. And I felt like I weighed nothing, and I felt like all of that burden and everything, all those knots in my stomach were taken out. And from that day until now, I have not ever had a moment where I've not been aware that God loved me. And that was my spiritual awakening, to find out that I fit in here on the planet and that God loved me. Not anything more profound than that, but that made all the world a difference. And so I started going out. Now I've had this spiritual awakening they're talking about, but I don't know what to do, and I don't have a job. And the retreat I was telling you about where we went to Gethsemane was coming up, and we went down there. And I went with some of these old-timers even, and we go down there, and the priest comes up, and he says, you boys know what God's will is, don't you? You're always talking about that. And, of course, either everybody was being particularly modest that day or nobody really had a clue. And he said, God's will is simple. It's to do the best you can with what God gives you right now. And it was like a little light went on. And he said, if you're a father, be a good father. If you're a husband, be a good husband. If you're a son, be a good son. If God got you sober in Alcoholics Anonymous, be a good member of Alcoholics Anonymous. If you have a talent and skill and you can use that and people pay you for it, then love your job and love other people honorably through that job. And if you've got a job that you hate, but you're able to help people honorably through that job, then love people through that job until God gives you something else. And a little light started going on. He said, it's pretty simple. God sees us. We're his children. He sees us the same way we see our children. And he said, if you men had a couple of seven-year-old boys and you gave them both little red wagons, and one of them takes that wagon around the neighborhood and spreads joy to the other kids and lets them play, and the other kid takes the wagon and kicks it over here and says, I want a scooter, who would you give more to? And I had always been the kid who, whatever you gave me, that wasn't good enough. I wanted something else. I was never happy with what you gave me. I was never happy with who I was. And a light went on. And that, again, changed my life profoundly. And the next week, now I see I'm supposed to do the best I can with what I have, but I need a job. So I go to the Friday old-timers luncheon at the Galt House, and at that meeting that day there was Wes R., Mike E., Bill H., who's sitting back there, and a guy named J.F., who was an attorney. And I'm telling them, these guys, that I need a job, a place to stay, a car, and some money. And I told them I needed the money so I could make amends. And I thought that sounded better. And so, and these guys don't even seem like they're talking about somebody got a new putter. They were talking about somebody had a Mercedes, condos, concepts that had nothing to do, how old-timers don't seem to catch the crisis of our emergencies. So they were sitting there having this conversation, and I thought they weren't paying a bit of attention to me. And after the luncheon, one of the guys named Jay, the attorney, says, "Why don't you bring a resume over and see me tomorrow or Monday?" And so I did, and half an hour after I met with him, I had a job, I had a car, I had a place to stay, and I had a lot less money than I thought I needed, but exactly the right amount of money to keep me sober. I was doing the press and advertising for a guy named Bill Stansberry, who ran for mayor, and I became the press secretary for the mayor and director of public affairs for the city as a result of going to this luncheon with all these old guys who were sitting around talking about things that had nothing to do with alcoholism. And that's exactly how it was supposed to work, because I was in the right place at the right time, and I was going to lots of meetings, and I was working with wet drunks, and I was doing all the things I was supposed to do. And even there, God, I never do, even these days, and I'll tell you one story before I close, but even these days, I don't always see what God's doing while he's in the middle of doing it. But back then, I get this job, and there were two reasons God gave me that job. I thought humility was kind of walking around being meek, and here I was on TV about every day, and that was when we had the snow in 78, where we shut down the city, and the mayor was out of town, so for about two or three days, the only person on television was me telling everybody to stay in. But I was the biggest liar in the world when I came into Alcoholics Anonymous, because I knew I couldn't be like my dad. I couldn't be one of these heroes, so I made up every story about me that I could. I was a jet pilot. I flew a Cessna. I was an attorney. I had one semester of pre-law. I was a doctor. I had one semester of pre-med. I was a baking soda salesman. I don't know where that came from, but it worked. There's some sick women out there. And so all of these things. Well, you can't tell three different reporters in a row at that time after Woodward and Bernstein three different stories without them catching you. So I went to my sponsor and Mike and Carter and all these people, and they're sitting there. They said, "Well, why don't you just keep it simple, talk about what you know about and tell the truth?" And that was a whole new concept for me. So I learned how to be honest through that job. The second thing was, I'd been locked up 22 times, so I didn't know how to make amends to these people. It turned out we had no program for these cops who were drunk, and their buddies were trying to keep them from being found out, so they were covering for them, and many of them were almost dying. And we set up the first amnesty program, and when I say we, I happen to be in office, but Jack, who was running the program for the railroads, was the one who really set it up. The first six guys that I 12-stepped were in the chief's office, and he said, "You can get fired and lose your retirement, or you can go with Dick," which is a great way to do a 12-step call. And the second one of those guys was a guy named C.D. with the last initial of H, and he got sober and he ran that program. He was a cop in the south end of Louisville who ran that program until he died. And God was using me already. And that's the way my life has been. Barbara and I have had a useful life. We've had a wonderful life because we've been able to travel a lot and we've been able to do a lot of things, but mostly we have found usefulness. And all I was doing all my life was looking for something. What I was really looking for was some kind of joy. Not just a high. I mean, I tried the high, but it was temporary. I was looking for that feeling like I belonged, like I was useful, like I was purposeful, the way my dad was, the way these military people in my family were. And even my mother's father, he was a coal miner, but he was proud of what he did, and they had, and I wasn't ever proud of what I did. I just wanted to be useful. And suddenly, I've started finding that out in a program of Alcoholics Anonymous. And I was able to take that same thing that I found in AA and carry it outside. And then it started working outside of Alcoholics Anonymous. And our life has been magnificent. And I'll tell you a story about our last year and a half that shows how God works in your life after you come in here and if you find out where that power is. Because I always thought those people had the power. But the big book says there is one who has all power. That one is God. Well, the good news is the reason I resented everybody was because I thought you had the power to make my life miserable. If none of us have power and we're all God's children, I think that's a pretty good deal. And here's what God did for us in the last year and a half. We started off about a year and a half ago. We have no children, but we had an elk hound that was like one and who had been to about 200 AA conferences and Al-Anon conferences with us. And we had to put him to sleep. And we were holding him in our arms. We live out in the country. We were holding him in our arms and put him to sleep. And I buried him under a tree next to the lake. And we were crying and could not stop crying and thought that's the worst thing that could ever happen. And within a short time period, Barbara's mom and dad died within 10 days of each other, and we were their caretakers. They had one had Alzheimer's, and the other one was starting to develop it. But we expected them to live for some time, but one had a heart attack, and I think that her mother did not want to be here without her husband. And suddenly we lose both of these people that are family that we're taking care of. And we felt kind of lost, and we went up to Toronto. I've been to 6 internationals. And Barbara's been to 4 of them with me. And we went up to Toronto, and we came back, and I was going through a physical. And the physical, the guy, you know, they call you, and if they call you back, if the doctor calls you back, it's never anything good. And it turned out I had esophageal cancer. And I'm not stupid, and I get on the Internet, and I found out last year there were 14,200 cases of esophageal cancer. 13,900 of them are dead now. 97% of the people who get esophageal cancer are dead within 6 months. And the week before I went to get my checkup, I had decided I wasn't going to go because I was busy and I wouldn't have any symptoms. I didn't suspect I had anything. But even then, your AA friends help you. A guy named Harry Heater called me and said, I just got diagnosed with esophageal cancer. And we talked about it, and I said, you're kidding. I'm supposed to go in for that test. And Harry died about 4 or 5 months later. But before Harry died, he gave me my life because he insisted that I go in, and he told me about what he was going through, and he knew he was on the way out. And so I had to find some place, and I couldn't tell Barbara that I had cancer because she just lost her mom and dad, and we put our dog to sleep, and I'm trying to figure out how by alone. My mom has, at this point, my mom had congestive heart failure, and I couldn't tell her, so I'm trying to figure out how I can find some place, and the doctor's telling me if I can't find a surgeon to do this within 30 days, my chances aren't very good. And we finally find the surgeon. Only a handful of people do this. They take your esophagus out and 2/3 of your stomach out and take your stomach material and make a new esophagus and rearrange your whole insides. And it's real difficult. It's about a 12-hour surgery. And so I'm trying to find somebody, and I found somebody in California at USC, but they wouldn't take my insurance. And a good friend of mine named Ed M., who speaks a lot, great big guy, 6'10", and that I'm on the phone with all the time, is saying, your job is just to rest in God's grace. And I'm thinking that, but after all God's done for me, I can't see that anything's working out because they won't take my insurance. And I'm afraid I'm going to die for lack of insurance. And about that time, we get a phone call back, and they said, by the way, the chief of surgery at USC just moved to Rochester, New York. Try him. So we call up there, and this doctor actually got on the phone with me. Because he was just starting, he was the chief of surgery at Strong Memorial. And he got on the phone with me and talked to me, and he said, yeah, we'll take the insurance. We know it's not going to pay us a lot, but we're trying to start a program up here. And he had been the chief surgeon for this guy out in California. So we're thinking, well, you know, maybe this will be second best. But it's still going to work. And so Barbara and I start to head up there. Well, the last time I spoke before we headed up there was in Key West. And I had 2 days where, for whatever reason, I started doubting everything. And I wasn't really afraid of dying because I had talked to Jack Sullivan the day that he was diagnosed with sick malignant brain tumors. And he didn't have any fear. And I asked him why he didn't have any fear, and he said, if God has been this good to me here, just imagine what he's got waiting for me on the other side. And that changed Jack, what Jack said, changed. So I wasn't afraid to go, but I just couldn't imagine God taking Barbara's our dog, Barbara's mom and dad, and me all in the same year. I didn't think that would happen. And I had 2 days before I spoke down there in Key West, and I couldn't pray. And the big book says that'll happen. And a friend of mine down there said, look, just try saying by rote something you've memorized. And I had memorized the 23rd Psalm when I was in the third grade to say before the PTA. As it turns out, it's a pretty good prayer when you're in trouble. And I started saying, the Lord is my shepherd, and I just kept repeating that psalm over and over and over. So Barbara and I drive to New York thinking we're still not sure this is the right place to go. And we walk into the hospital, and we go to the first place we go to is the chapel. And we walk into the chapel, and there on the wall, 30 foot high in foot and a half letters, is, the Lord is my shepherd, I shall not want. And it was the 23rd Psalm. And we started to know that we were in the right place. And we went out into the lobby to find out where this place was that God had brought us. And it was Strong Memorial Hospital. And Strong was Dr. Leonard Strong, who was Bill Wilson's brother-in-law, who started the Alcoholic Foundation, who was our first non-alcoholic trustee. And without any help from us, God had arranged for us to go to the very best place on the planet, and we knew it, and we relaxed, and as my friend Ed said, my job was to relax in God's grace, plus use the little thing you blow in. And if you've ever been in a hospital, you know what I'm talking about. And I had that surgery on September 13th of 2005, and I still have little things. I never know what's going to happen when I eat because they cut the vagal nerve, so it's kind of like a surprise. Sometimes you are going to the bathroom 10 minutes later, sometimes you're not. But I'm playing tennis, and I'm going to AA, and I'm working, and Barbara and I have a full life and an effective life. And when we leave here on Sunday, I'll mention one more thing. My mom died right in the middle of all this as well, too. But her body was worn out, and we had learned a little bit from the program to see things through God's eyes. That there's a time to go, and Jack had given us that gift. So in the year that could have been the worst year in our lives, where we lost 3 out of 4 parents, put our dog to sleep, and I had not so terminal cancer, we have never had more joy because in the middle of everything, we felt God's presence. And how can I complain about an ordinary day after all that he's done for us? And that's all I was looking for. And one of the letterhead we got from this thing was as a gathering of miracles. And the big book promises we still live in the age of miracles. Our own recovery proves that. And if you're new or if you're at a stopping point in the program, like I was, I got kind of away from here between 12 and 15 years, and I got suicidal even though I didn't drink by the time I was 15 years again. And I know a lot of people that have depressions and stuff when they're 10, 15, even 20 years. But if you're at a point where you're hitting your head, start over. And please don't leave before you find your miracle. Thank you.